Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody, I got a great one today, you know, for a change. You know, I got a comment the other day from a listener who wrote, "Al, I love your podcast, but stop saying it's a great one for a change because it's insulting to your previous guests." I hadn't thought of that, so I called my previous guests and asked them if they felt that way, and only Norm Ornstein said he had a problem with it. Norm said he was very, very hurt. So I've got a great one today for a change, except for the ones that Norm Ornstein did, which are always terrific. My guest today is Jeremy Peters, who's been a correspondent for the New York Times for 15 years and is an MSNBC contributor. So unlike my other guests, he knows what he's talking about, which in this case is about his new book, Insurgency, How Republicans Lost Their Party and Got Everything They Ever Wanted. It's a great read because every right-wing asshole from the last 20 years is featured. I mean, practically every one of them. There's an old saying, if assholes could fly, there would be no sunlight. So you got your Limbaugh, your Gingrich, your Roger Ailes, your Sarah Palin, your Steve Bannon, your Sean Hannity. And it's really about how they've always been there, but how after the Republican Party had fielded establishment presidential candidates like George H.W. Bush, Bob Dole, George W. Bush, John McCain, and Mitt Romney, we got Donald Trump, who completed the devolution of the Republican Party into a dark, angry, authoritarian party that considers beating up Capitol Police with the aim of killing Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi and overturning the election to be legitimate political discourse. This is what we got now. Even so, this was kind of a fun conversation. Peter, are you there?
I'm here.
Let me get your impression of this. I felt, and tell me if you think this is an accurate. He laughs a lot during this interview, right?
He does, yeah.
Okay, and that's not terribly unusual. I'm funny, but did you get the sense that he's probably done a lot of really serious interviews about this book, and that he was just getting a little tired of that, or this was refreshing? How about that? That this was refreshing.
Well, yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It's not a light subject that he's tackling. You know, the complete and total collapse of one of the only functioning political parties in this country.
When he says everything they want, I don't want to ruin things for him in the interview, but when he said, you know, part of that is he got the evangelicals, Trump did, by pledging to nominate only judges that the Federalist Society recommended. And so the evangelicals went for him. And even though, you know, why would evangelicals like a person like Donald Trump? Although he says in the book that a lot of evangelicals are really mad and mean. So I guess that makes sense. But it's a fun one, don't you think?
I do.
And For this topic.
Yeah, you said something in the Heather McGee interview last week about how sometimes things are just so dark and so upsetting that your reaction is to laugh. And I think that that's kind of where Jeremy is.
Yeah, he did put a lot of reporting, a lot of work, and there's some great nuggets in there in the book. And we'll get to some of those, in a lot of those in the interview. Well, great. Thanks, Peter. That was easy. I didn't have to write anything except that opening. Norm Ornstein wasn't the one insulted. It was Dahlia Lithwick. Oh, by the way, I'm going to be on the Tonight Show Wednesday, March 2nd. I'm going to be Jimmy Fallon's guest, and I'll be talking about the State of the Union address there on the Tonight Show. Well, we got a great one today, you know, for a change. Jeremy Peters is my guest, and we're going to be talking about how the right-wing nutcases have taken over the Republican Party. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Jeremy Peters is with me today. Jeremy has been a correspondent for the New York Times for more than 15 years. He's also a political contributor for MSNBC. That's the Microsoft National Broadcasting Company, headquartered in New York City. Is that correct, Jeremy?
That is correct, yes. I believe you used to work for one of their entities at some point, didn't you?
I did. It was the NBC part, yeah.
Yes.
Jeremy has a new book out, Insurgency, How Republicans Lost Their Party and Got Everything They Ever Wanted. It's about how the Republican Party has become what it is today, a party that considers assaulting Capitol Police, gouging out their eyes, breaking their vertebrae, spraying them with bear spray, slamming them with hockey sticks and baseball bats, giving them traumatic brain injuries, considering all of that to be legitimate political discourse. Were you sorry you couldn't get that in the book? How friggin' amazing it is. You know, in your book, you just have this line of assholes that you profile and their role in all of this. And it's Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh, of course, Sean Hannity, mm-hmm. Pat Buchanan, who at least could mm-hmm. be kind of fun to be with, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he's not, you know. Roger Ailes, a monster, but also kind of charming.
Yep. So, I mean, sociopaths are often quite charming.
Then you have some sort of less well-known assholes. You know, the guy from Operation Veritas. What's his name?
Right. Yeah. James O'Keefe.
James O'Keefe. Just a whole slew of these guys. You know, Alex Jones, mm-hmm. Steve Bannon, Glenn Beck. Ann Coulter, Tucker Carlson.
If you keep going, no one's going to want to read this book.
Newt Gingrich. Well, no, it's all like a trip down nightmare lane. Giuliani, Stephen Miller gets shows up, Breitbart, Karl Rove, Roger Stone. And of course, you kind of start with Sarah Palin. And what's fascinating about this is just how the Republican Party just got taken over by these insurgents, and it's their party now, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, every one of those people you named through, for the most part, were kind of at the periphery of the conservative movement in the Republican Party. I mean, these were not people who were invited to speak at Mitt Romney's Republican National Convention. And they were dismissed, and they were laughed at and disrespected to a large degree by the Republican leadership. And that was a really important part of their political identity, and created a real galvanizing sentiment, I think, among a lot of them, and why they identified with Trump, because Trump is ultimately somebody who is not ideological. He's driven solely by his grievance and his desire for revenge. And it's something I get into in the chapter. I'm glad you mentioned Roger Ailes, because there's a scene which has long been like lost to into the void of canceled cable news shows. But Roger Ailes, when he was president of CNBC, gave himself a talk show, and he had all sorts of interesting.
I was on that talk show, believe it or not.
Were you really? That's amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
I mean, consider yourself flattered, because he picked really interesting people to be on that show. And one of them was Donald Trump. You probably don't enjoy being in that company. But like in 1995, of course, Donald Trump was not a political figure, but he in many ways was the same type of grievance oriented character that he is now. And Roger says to him, you know, I don't get it, Donald, like these construction workers, the road crews, they say, hey, Donald, you know, how are you doing? We love you. And you're this millionaire from Manhattan. How does that work? And Trump's answer is as resonant today as it was back then. He says, well, it's because the rich people, they're the ones that don't like me. So what Trump was doing there is that, you know, he identified that it's not just about his appeal. It's about who people think hates him. And it's about his enemies as much as it is anything in his own personal character that people find appealing.
Oh, man. I shouldn't say I hate him then. That gives him fuel. You know what's interesting? I mean, basically, what the arc of this book is how the party became the Trump Party. And if you think about who the nominees and a couple Bush presidents, who the nominees for the Republican Party were since, you know, 88, H.W., then you profile Buchanan, who challenged H.W. in 92. Mm-hmm. But then it was Bob Dole. Mm-hmm. Then it was George W. Bush. Then it was McCain. And then it was Romney. And those were what we used to think of when we thought of Republicans. Mm-hmm. And then it was Trump.
And then so what you're doing right there, and you would have no way of knowing this, but you're actually spelling out the idea that formed my book proposal. I was having lunch with a well-known Republican strategist who worked for all of those people, except for Trump, who you just named, over the years, including he worked with Roger Ailes. And he said to me, you know, one of the things that we're going to be puzzling over for years is looking at that line of Republican nominees, Bush, McCain, Romney, and who? And I felt that question, the who, how, like, how did it get to this guy? Explain this, because 25 years from now, when people are in grade schools or looking at the wall and the portraits of the presidents above the chalkboard there, Donald Trump's picture is going to still be there. And there's going to be a lot of explaining to do about how we got to that point, because it looks like such an anomaly. And what my book tries to argue is that Trump wasn't an anomaly in the Republican Party. He was actually kind of the soul of it for the last 25, 30 years, starting with, you know, a guy like Buchanan, who ran in 92 on a lot of the ideas that Trump ended up running.
Yeah. And if you think about it now, Romney is the anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this has always been there. This has always been, and the roots are in the Tea Party. But it's also, I mean, you talk about Limbaugh, mm-hmm. about how he got this.
I think you wrote a book about him, didn't you?
Yes.
Or he was in the title, at least.
Well, no, it was about, it was largely about this. It was funny. I wrote that in 95. It's called Rush Limbaugh's A Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. And basically, my thesis was that he's spreading a lot of disinformation, and that's dangerous.
Well, yeah, exactly. I could have grabbed it from the book, from your book, because what it's true, the what Limbaugh called, as you well know, the four corners of deceit on his radio show, you know, academia, government, science, and the media. I mean, that was conditioning his audience for years and years not to trust authority and knowledge. And so we shouldn't at all be surprised by the time we get to 2020 and Trump says, they're stealing this from you, the media, the Democratic Party. It's all a big conspiracy. They had been hearing that kind of stuff for years. They'd been hearing it was a hoax from Trump for ever since he started running for president. And he even before that, when he claimed that the Emmys were rigged because he'd never been nominated for an Emmy for The Apprentice.
Yeah, they are.
Well,
I'm very bitter about that. I've only won five. I deserve more. Well,
the Academy aside, I think Trump is was speaking there to like this sense that people who identified with conservative movement politics, who identified with the Republican Party, but not exclusively with the Republican Party, felt like they were one presidential election away from losing their purchase on cultural, political, and social power in this country. And they thought that for a variety of reasons, you know.
And that election was Obama.
Yeah, that election was Obama, right? Yeah. That's exactly
that
right.
That freaked them out, boy. That freaked them out.
Well, yeah, it really did. I mean, and you know, because, you know, you served with John McCain, and McCain is an interesting figure in the book, because what I report that hasn't really been out there before is the extent to which the McCain campaign was actually using the grievances and the anger out there in a way that they crafted Sarah Palin's words for her. Sarah Palin, when McCain chose her, she took a dark turn because the McCain people not only allowed her to do it, they wrote those words into her script, including the most famous line, I think, that she ever uttered during that campaign, that Obama was, quote, palling around with terrorists. That came from the McCain campaign headquarters.
And I think that would surprise everyone, because you don't think of Steve Schmidt, who was running that campaign, and you don't think of McCain stooping to that, but they did. Mm-hmm.
But he did, yeah. Right? Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated part of his legacy, because for all that he was, you know, a war hero who you know, stood up against the Bush administration's use of terrorism, and somebody who ran as a maverick himself against the establishment Republican Party, it's a complicated legacy, because ultimately the choice of Sarah Palin was on him, and he let this happen.
It was sort of a Hail Mary. They thought they... You know, they needed something, right?
They needed something, yeah.
Yeah. You forget that William Crystal was like a big champion of hers.
What I love most about the Bill Crystal story, and you might appreciate this, is...
Let's explain who Bill Crystal is.
Please.
I think our audience knows. I actually had him as one of my guests. Chief of staff for Dan Quayle. What was his the magazine he did?
The Weekly Standard.
The Weekly Standard. And now he's a never-Trumper, et cetera. But the Weekly Standard did a cruise to Alaska, you know, fundraising tour, a cruise. And they stopped, and he was very impressed with her. And he kind of suggested her, right?
He did. Yes, he absolutely did.
I think because he regrets that, boy.
Oh, he absolutely does. But what he tells me in the book, which is, you know, I mean, hindsight is everything, right? He says that, you know, back then it wasn't as clear to him that she considered herself to come from a different part of the Republican Party, right? Like he described that lunch to me as, oh, this is Sarah Palin, the Republican governor, and she is inviting these Republicans she sees on Fox News to come meet with her. And he didn't see it as even given that what he should have known about her history as somebody who took on establishment Republicans and beat them, like Governor Frank Murkowski, who she killed off in a primary, that she was capable of using her that populist energy and turning it against their party, turning against John McCain, really. And what fascinated me about Crystal, it's an interesting footnote that people probably forget about his background, is he was the one involved in, remember the Murphy Brown versus Dan Quayle?
Sure. Yeah. He was Dan Quayle's chief of staff, and they made a big deal about her being a single mom or something, and how it,
exactly,
because she decided to keep her baby instead of having an abortion, which evidently Quayle would have preferred.
Right. It wasn't the most logical of
no.
to pick, right?
Yeah.
But Crystal's involved in that, and the speechwriter, the speechwriters who are working on Dan Quayle's speech, where he famously said of Murphy Brown and her Hollywood ilk, "I wear your scorn like a badge of honor." Those speechwriters ended up working with Sarah Palin on her speech in 2008. So the book, what I hope you and other people take away from it is the way that there are these threads of Trumpism, which ultimately is like it's a grievance based identity. This idea that there are people out there who think they're better than you, like famously saw Obama's saying, those people who cling to their guns and religion and Hillary's deplorables, it's that type of attitude that was there all along.
Those are two mistakes.
Yes.
Don't make those kinds of mistakes. The deplorables, they just grabbed onto that. They and wore that, of course, as a badge of honor.
Oh, yeah. They make T-shirts out of it.
Yeah. And so this goes back, Limbaugh, of course, gets the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And what I like about it is that you write about that, when you write about him getting that, is that Trump, this is very Trump. Mm-hmm. He brings him to the State of the Union and announces it. And Limbaugh already knew it, but Limbaugh did an acting job, which is, oh my God, I didn't realize I was going to get that, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, at the White House.
Yeah. So anyway, which is great. But Trump, this is how Trump thinks. And there's all kinds of things. Of course, like bringing Juanita Broderick to the debates, this kind of shit, is that everybody knew Limbaugh was dying. He had stage 4 lung cancer. And so he had him in the balcony and announced it and spent a lot of time praising him. And he just relished the idea that Democrats had to, like, what do we do? The guy's dying.
Exactly.
And so, it was win-win. If they applauded for him, they weren't going to applaud for him. But then it was like, aha, these Democrats are terrible. The man's dying and they won't applaud for him. But
I mean, it's reality television as the presidency. That's what he was good at.
Now, here's the thing. I've heard you interviewed and saying that you think that it's very possible they move past Trump, and that this whole thing about him, just the grievance about the election, that people want to kind of move beyond that. I disagree with you.
Okay.
I think that that's just Trump. I think he's kind of sui generis. I think he's a, he's an autocrat. He's a, he's a psychopath. I think they like that about him, that he holds grievances. Yeah. I think he's got a hold of this party. That's why the Republican National Committee called that legitimate political discourse. There's also, this is about a charismatic leader, right? I don't see anybody else in the Republican field that holds a candle to him on that kind of thing. I mean, I think
they don't. No, I agree.
And he's like a classic. Mm-hmm. Isn't he?
He is. He is. It's true. He is. And I think the question is how long he can, he kind of sticks around and holds their attention. I think I was trying to leave it open to the possibility that what happens to Trump is that the base gets too far to the right of him. which you've started to see in some ways. But I would agree with you that he is, there is no, Ron DeSantis and Mike Pence and these other guys, they are not going to be able to replicate what Trump did. Don Jr. is not going to be, it's there's no replicating what Trump does, because I don't think, I mean, as we were just saying, he's such a showman. I mean, and that's why I focus on Limbaugh in the book so much, in drawing a comparison to the way that he and Trump understood how to use media, is that it's, you can't teach that. And
right,
both of them were masters in that field.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, because to me, it without Limbaugh, there might not be a Trump.
I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. And I think that's why I found it so revelatory in my conversations with Trump. And this is, almost feels silly saying this, that Donald Trump had something introspective and insightful to say about himself, because he's not exactly the kind of guy who sits around thinking about everyone that's helped him and how he's formed this worldview that he's sharing with the rest of us. He's not an incredibly thoughtful guy when it comes to turning that lens on himself. But he said to me, Limbaugh gave him some advice during the transition in 2016, that stuck with him. And that was
the transition, meaning the
presidential
campaign.
Transition between Obama and Trump. So this is like,
so in other words, after he won.
Yeah. It's like around Christmas after he had won. And
okay.
He
so that's 16.
Still stunned. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 16. So sorry, I said 15, but yeah. So we're all still stunned that, you know, he's going to be the next president of the
yes.
United States. And I mean, I vividly remember my keyboard at the New York Times, like typing in the words "President-elect Donald Trump," and it—I mean, that took some getting.
Did you vomit? I mean, did you have to get a new computer?
I did not. No, I didn't vomit. But it was one of those things where it was a daily reminder, because, you know, I would type those words into my computer every day. Almost, I was writing a story. It was just a daily reminder of how surreal this was and what a historic change we were undergoing as a country. And not always for the good. But I think that Trump was, the Limbaugh comparison is so interesting, because Limbaugh just wasn't somebody that Trump admired as a broadcaster. And, you know, he was a neighbor in Palm Beach and they went golfing together. But some of the most formative political advice he ever got came from Rush Limbaugh, I think says all you need to know about the way that he conducted his presidency, the way he viewed his presidency.
What was the advice? What was the advice?
The advice was, to him from Limbaugh, don't ever cut deals with Democrats, because, and it's not the actual advice itself that's so interesting, it's the reason. Limbaugh said, because the Democrats and the left will never give you credit for it. They will always hate you, and if you try to appease them, it will never work. And
so productive.
I think it's exactly right.
Oh, man. You know, it makes me, God, that's a patriot.
Right? So that's the, I mean, and then look at Trump's presidency, with the exception of maybe attempting to cut a deal on getting some type of immigration reform done for the kids who came here when they were really young.
He didn't do that.
They didn't even do that.
Yeah. He didn't even get an infrastructure bill.
No.
Which is hilarious, because, you know, he's the builder, right?
Right.
And everyone wanted it. We all wanted it. I couldn't believe that we couldn't do it. Every week was infrastructure week, remember? And just no one didn't want infrastructure. And he still couldn't do it. It's amazing how awful this guy was in so many different ways. So let's talk about some of the assholes here that you in the book. Which ones? I mean, Bannon, Glenn Beck. Mm. You pick them. I mean, there's a Cruz, you know, who you want to talk about, you know, Roger Stone. All these people are just part of this story.
Yeah, I think Bannon is an interesting one, right? Because he wasn't always there with Trump. And I get into this story in 2000. It's the summer of 2010. And it's kind of an overlooked episode in the creation of Trump's political identity. and his understanding of what worked with his voters. But the Ground Zero mosque episode back in 2010
was a
huge controversy, right? It wasn't a mosque, but it was an Islamic cultural center, much like a JCC or a YMCA, except for it was going to be run by Muslims.
I remember that. It was after 9/11, and this guy wanted to build a cultural center, right? You know, a mm-hmm. place like a JCC, except for Muslims.
Yeah, exactly, right? And you know, you would have thought...
An MCC.
Exactly. But you would have thought that they were erecting a monument to bin Laden on Ground Zero.
Well, they shouldn't have called it the Bin Laden Community Center, but...
Right. that was
a mistake.
To your question, like, when did they learn or how did they learn to distort this stuff and lie about it, the construction of it in the right-wing media as a mosque was like entirely fitting with what was happening on the airwaves of Fox News and on Rush Limbaugh's show. The idea was so provocative and so outlandish and so inflaming that it became too good to fact check, too good to say, well, actually, no, there's a little bit more nuance here. Because it played out in the right-wing media, that's how people like Trump saw it, because what did he do most of the day? He watched television.
Well, what was interesting is he took this. I mean, obviously, I wrote Rush Limbaugh's a big fat idiot and other observations, and I wrote Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them a Fair and Balanced Look the Right. So I was kind of warning about this, and I was very mm-hmm. cognizant of they were just lying. But there's a difference between that and the president lying all the time.
Right. And then lying about the lies, right? Like, what are you talking about? No, I haven't been golfing as much as more than Obama.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite lies that he does is the one where he talked about injecting disinfectant into you. And in the debate with Biden, he goes, "I was being sarcastic, and you know it." It's like, no, you weren't. Well, play that back. You know, you were not being sarcastic.
Well, for a while, he was still denying that it was him on the Access Hollywood tape. He said, "There's no proof that that's actually my voice." It's like, this is when he was still president. Like, and it's pretty clear who's speaking on the tape.
The lies, this guy just, you know, from day one, of course, day one was I had the biggest inaugural. Like, it was like, and that's when Kellyanne Conway said there are alternative facts, which is mm-hmm. fabulous. Fabulous. Right. Thank you very much.
That could have been the title of my book, too, because it just sums up so perfectly what's happened to the Republican.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? And it's mm-hmm. so dangerous. And by the way, when you say that kids will look up and see Donald Trump's picture, mm-hmm. The president, they'll see Donald Trump, then they'll see Biden, and then they'll see Donald Trump again, and he'll still be president when these kids are in school. Because he's just becoming ill. That's it. It's over. It'll be a dictatorship. I mean, it'll be an authoritarian regime. We will not have a democratic election again. I mean, it'll be like Hungary or something like that, and it'll all be fraud and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like the seeds for the lying, as you well know, a lot of it starts with voter fraud, right? This idea that I think Republicans couldn't come to terms with the fact that they were losing on their ideas.
Yeah, well, you have Ailes saying to Romney mm-hmm. that they...
I love that scene.
That's amazing. Ailes is saying to Romney, well, they stole it. They cheat.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if you watch Fox, I mean, it's funny because I used to describe that as like that scene in Citizen Kane where, you know, he's losing the governor's race and the guys at the running the press room at one of his papers had it all laid out. You know, Kane wins. And then when they figure out he's not going to win, they scramble the letters and they change it to Kane loses, fraud at polls. It's just this instinct that they have to deny that the Republican Party has to deny that their ideas and their leaders are not representative of the majority of the people. Because remember, this is the party that told itself it was a majority, whether it was Richard Nixon's silent majority or Ralph Reed's moral majority. They really do talk themselves into this. And you know, you asked about Bannon. One of the interesting things about Bannon is, you know, when you get him talking about Trump in candid moments, he is well aware and very keen an observer of Trump's flaws and his recklessness. And one of the things he said to me was, Trump is the guy who believes the lie as soon as it comes out of his mouth. Now, of course, he then added a dig to Bill Clinton and said, you know, he's kind of like Bill Clinton. He's the guy that could pass the lie detector test. And I think that that's really true. It's a capacity that I don't have, that I'm sure you don't have, that most of us don't have. But he is just
when I lie, I'm aware of it.
Right. And I think he's not.
Actually, I was just lying. Sorry, that was not great. As a joke, it was okay. You laughed, so that counts. Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, it just is mind-boggling. He just lies all the time, and they. What percentage of the self-identified Republicans in this country believe the election was stolen?
Oh, it's depending on the poll. It's in the way they ask the question. It's you know, half to two thirds who believe that Biden isn't legitimate, and they have this extraordinary capacity. And this isn't exactly lying, but it's this that's in the same vein, because it's this denial of reality and this ability to whitewash and look past the ugly things that Trump did. January 6th is the ultimate example of it. You have Kevin McCarthy and all these folks in the immediate aftermath, the weeks after January 6th, who are saying that Trump is responsible. He should be censured. Then they see that because, in part because Trump is lying to his base and saying, no, this wasn't, these were interlopers, this was Antifa, this wasn't really our people.
And Black Lives Matter people were there and who really did a good job of hiding their race.
There was like one guy, I think, that they found who had been arrested for his association in like an anarchist leftist protest. One guy in the Capitol. And then, it becomes, no, this is all an Antifa false flag operation. But
and that's the guy who smeared his feces on the wall.
Right. Or the blood on the statue of Zachary Taylor.
Jesus,
right?
Like Christ.
These were all patriots. Good people who were just on a tour, right? Remember, they were just, they stayed
in the rows. You'd think it was just a regular tourist visit.
Yeah, exactly right.
The storming of the Bastille was just a tourist visit to the Bastille.
That's another false flag, right? Yeah, but that's what I try to get at as the heart of the book is how this party became, how it allowed itself to get so detached from reality to deny the obvious, to accept the demonstrably false as truth. And a lot of that starts with the right wing media, from Limbaugh to Ailes. But you never had a president who was as willing to lie about everything. He lied about how much he weighed and how tall he was and how healthy he was.
Well, everyone does that. Come on.
Saying he was the most. It's probably true.
Come on. That's like the least of it. I mean, that's, I think that the election was stolen is worse than lying about your weight. For example, I'm 160.
So am I.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just it's so friggin' disturbing that and I worry of course about voter suppression. Remember Hillary won the popular vote by about 3 million votes, right? So yes. Trump does like, okay, he points his commission.
Yes, the Blue Ribbon Voter Fraud Commission.
Kobach, is that the guy from Kansas? And So they found nothing. Nothing. No fraud, nothing.
Right. I mean, they're still finding nothing.
Yeah, and they still find nothing. And how these people, what am I saying? How these people believe this shit? They just do. Oh, man. Okay, more assholes. let's see. Who am I? Glenn Beck what I like about the Glenn Beck thing is that Ailes puts him on, mm-hmm. and then Glenn Beck gets too popular.
Too crazy.
And too crazy. And at one point, Ailes sees some kind of, who the most influential right-wing...
It was a list that like someone had published, some publication. It's, I think it was The Independent in Britain, published a list of the most influential conservatives. And this guy interviewing Roger Ailes says, well, a couple ticks above you on this list is Glenn Beck. and Ale scoffs. Glenn's not a conservative. And the reason I put that in the book is because that's Trump, right? Like, Trump is not a conservative. Like Beck, he is a performer. He is somebody who, he's a broadcaster who knows what his audience wants.
But what I loved about it was he just couldn't stand the idea that Glenn Beck was, someone thought Glenn Beck was more important than him.
Yes, that is absolutely, and that's why he ended up hating Donald Trump. Because, you know, as long as Roger Ailes had been running Fox, his idea for what he for the role he should be performing as head of the network was that he was going to drag these Republicans over the finish line and elect them president. Right? They wouldn't be able to do it themselves. There's this great scene that I have in there where Ailes is, you know, this is years before Fox News, and he's George H.W. Bush's debate coach, or one of them, and he's getting in HW's face. This is the president of the United States at the time. And it's like, you have to, he's talking about how to debate Bill Clinton, coaching him on that. He says, you have to get in that fat fuck's face and you have to tell him. Da, 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 da. I mean, and that's the thing is, and I open the book with this scene that just shows you how that model of Republican politics was just being smashed, because the Bush family, you know, the generations of public service, you know, they use their wealth and their privilege and their power to give back to their country. And that's why I opened the book with the scene of Sarah Palin and George Bush meeting for the first time. They're on Air Force One. George Bush is on Air Force One. He's Sarah Palin's governor. This is a few weeks before she's selected vice president. Neither of them.
This is W, of course.
W. Yeah. Neither of them knows that McCain's about to pick her. And he hardly knows who she is. He doesn't even know how to pronounce her last name. And in 4 weeks, she's going to be a bigger star in the Republican Party than he is.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jeremy Peters of the New York Times.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court. Was it Trump's idea or was it one of his advisors' idea to say, I'm just going to only choose Supreme Court nominees that are recommended by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation?
I think because he was so utterly transactional, he was talked into this idea.
Because it's a brilliant idea. I mean, that won the election, right?
It absolutely won the election.
Everything won the election. It was so close.
I mean, right. It was a number of factors that you don't win the election without the religious right. And in order to get the religious right on board with a guy who has, as you know, as long a record as Trump does of being completely offensive to anything religious, he needed to do a few things. One of those was to ensure them that he wasn't going to be like the Bushes and appoint liberal Supreme Court justices, which both Bushes, well, I mean, Roberts isn't exactly a liberal, but a lot of conservatives would say he's not a conservative either. And the other one was appointing Mike Pence as sure, his vice presidential nominee. And that really got them in line. And so I think it surprised a lot of evangelicals, at least the evangelical leadership in the party, that their voters were fine with being so transactional.
Well, I mean, look what they got. I mean, the biggest thing is to get rid of Roe v. Wade, and they're going to do that.
That's why the subtitle is, you know, Republicans lost their party and got everything they ever wanted, because that's how you look past January 6th. That's how you adopt a worldview that is rooted in delusion and in denial of reality that's inconvenient to you, because you can say, well, he at least we're saving babies. And the people I talk to, I'm not belittling that. That's what they say. It really is a bargain that was worth making as far as they're concerned.
And the other bargain is the corporate Republicans, the establishment mm-hmm. Republicans. The Supreme Court makes it, you know, harder for labor unions to organize, right? You know, it's all these pro-corporate the decisions that they make. So that was part of their transaction too. They were, most of these people probably don't like Trump, but
true,
that's the deal. And one of the things that does worry me about all this, and I think it worries everybody else, is my former colleagues, Republican colleagues, I do text them every once in a while. They are afraid to go against Trump, but they know who he is and what he is. But they're afraid because the Republican Party base is Trump's base.
Yes.
Or is his Trump people.
Yeah.
So they're afraid. And I've had, you know, after some teeth pulling, I've had a number of my colleagues go like, look, if I say the election wasn't stolen, then I will lose my primary and you'll get a bigger nut. not, they don't consider themselves nuts. You'll get a nut.
Right. Well, look at the woman, Nancy Mace, who
dared
to speak the truth and on January 6th and blamed Trump. And Trump endorsed her opponent in the primary. And now she's groveling outside Trump Tower, filming a video on her iPhone saying how she's Trump's biggest supporter. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, your private conversations with these Republican senators, because that's what I hear too. That's what they all say. They will lose their primary because they're afraid. I mean, they won't say that they're afraid of their voters, but like that's the truth. The reality is they are afraid of their voters. I think it's not just that they're afraid. It's that they don't understand their voters, because I think if you're somebody like Nancy Mace, to think that that's going to do the trick with Trump voters, to go and stand in front of Trump Tower and pledge your loyalty to him on your iPhone, like that, who's going to be convinced to vote for you because of that?
I don't know. I mean, there's also the stupidity factor.
Yes.
That you can't discount.
Yes.
I mean, they might go, oh, I see. She's for, you know, they'll just watch that thing and go, oh, great. I didn't know that. She's really pro-Trump. I don't know.
They could. I mean, well, the thing, you know, is Trump's endorsement, and this is an interesting point, is an interesting distinction that I think gets lost on a lot of people about the real power that Trump has over these Republicans in office. It's not so much the endorsement as it is the attacks that he decides to wage, right? So if he goes after you, that's when you're in trouble. That's what Lil Marco, Lion Ted, and I think to your point earlier about how he still is likely to have a hold on this party for a long time, and I don't disagree with you, because I don't think that there's anyone else who's going to come along that can do what he can do. He has so bullied these Republican senators. So they're so afraid of what will happen to them if he starts taunting them, because they've seen it happen to their colleagues. I mean, some of your former colleagues, you know, I mean, whether it's Jeff Flake or Bob Corker, you know, these guys that he ran out of office because he started antagonizing them. And that speaks to the cultural change in the Republican Party, or at least the acceptance now of this, maybe it's not a change at all, but it's just they're willing to do it in the open, where the ridicule, the mean-spiritedness of it all is sport for a lot of these people, and they like it, and it's a reason they vote for him.
You know, one of the people you're right about is Sean Hannity, and just the shameless lying. He knows what he's doing, right?
He knows exactly what he's doing. Yeah.
And you just wonder, like, wow, what is that? What's your self, your self-image? I can't be successful unless I just spread lies and poison.
Well, I think what they've done is they've talked themselves, because the Democratic Party and certain Democratic politicians have given them quite a caricature to run with and proposed a lot of policies that are just incredibly unpopular and nonsensical, that they are able to tell themselves that the left is so awful that we can put, you know, that they hate, the left hates us so much and the left will so destroy this country because they, you know, they exaggerate and they embellish and they make it sound as if like Ilhan Omar is the real Speaker of the House, when like, I don't know the last time a backbench congresswoman has received so much national attention in the conservative media. But they do people like Hannity do a very good job of exaggerating the mistakes that Democratic politicians make and the ill-advised policies that they end up getting backed into a corner over. And that's easier than having to defend Trump, which of course they're perfectly happy to do.
Yeah. It's depressing. So are you worried? I mean, are you worried that it's all over democracy and we're screwed?
I mean, I don't want to diminish like the seriousness of the threats that like we face. I'm just an optimistic person by nature, and I think that there's a reason. Probably, maybe I'm not old enough yet. But I think that, like, you know, look, voters looked at Trump's record in 2020 and they made a choice. And you can say that they very narrowly made that choice, even though the popular vote says one thing, but the 40,000 votes in, you know, a handful of states really shows you the closeness of this.
Well, it shows you how the Electoral College is so screwy.
Completely. But I think that you are right when, you know, you said that Trump has a real shot at this again. And people, you know, they ask me a lot of times, because when I spoke to him for this book, the question of what he's going to do in 2024 is always there lingering, even though I never asked it directly. I could tell over the course of our interviews as he was getting angrier and angrier and more detached from reality, that he is running to avenge what he sees as this, you know, this grave injustice carried out against him. And he wants this back. You know, and he's going to tell people, this is your chance to get your country back. And as we know, and as I write in the book, I think that phrase is on the first page of my book, that these conservatives who, over the course of American history, at least, you know, the second half of the 20th century and this part of the 21st century so far, have been galvanized by that sentiment, this idea that their country is slipping away from them. And that's just how the Stop the Steal stuff might be Trump's ace in the hole, because he's saying to them, like, they stole this from me, but they also stole it from you. Let's take it back.
It also is just white people worried about losing their status, you know, their cultural status. That's part of what this is tapping into, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things that, I mean, yes. And as you correctly pointed out, like, that's why the Obama election, what so outraged a lot of these voters who became Tea Party people, once they saw that Obama was, and I mean, you were there for this, once they saw that Obama was going to pass this universal healthcare law, once they saw that.
Well, it wasn't universal, was expanding. Okay, yeah. The ACA.
Right. You know, what they started to see him as the right wing caricature, that he's this socialist, right, who's fundamentally changing the character of the country. And that was one thing, like, in theory, to hear from people like McCain on the campaign trail. But, you know, they latch onto this idea that a law expanding healthcare access is somehow like a socialist takeover of the country, in part because they were told this by a very well-financed right-wing political operation.
Yeah, and what happened was that, of course, Trump said that he's going to replace Obamacare with something terrific. And and then I thought, like, oh, well, okay, he wins. And I'm guessing, well, I guess the Cato Institute and, you know, American Enterprise Institute and Heritage Foundation must have put together kind of a market-based thing, the substitute. And what they came up with was so horrible. It was like 23 million Americans would have lost coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It was so awful, and it went down. Thank God for McCain's thumb down. And then, remember what Trump said? He said, "Who knew healthcare was so complicated?" And the answer is everybody, you asshole.
Well, who knew the economy was so complicated? Who knew managing a pandemic could be so complicated? And that's ultimately, you know, when you talk to people, as I did for this book, the people who were honest about his leadership could see that he was incapable of any type of real leadership, especially when it all came home with a pandemic, a racial reckoning, and an economic collapse. It's just not something he was ever interested in doing or built for.
Oh, no. I mean, the guy watched TV, watched Fox, can't read. I mean, can read, I think, but he doesn't read. Mm-hmm. And he wanted all his briefings oral, you know, and then would get impatient if they were long. And I mean,
we look at that and think, like, wow, that guy is so ill-suited. Voters and a lot of voters judged him to be completely ill-qualified to be the president of the United States. But I think a lot of people still look at that and they're like, oh, he's not a politician, right? That's, it's this like authenticity.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you looked at those Republican debates and, you know, in 16, basically all of them were politicians and they talked in talking points and Trump just sounded like a human being, an odd human being, an awful human being, but nevertheless, you know, interesting. I mean,
well, an insult entertaining. Is how I often saw him. As he could be withering and quite funny in his insults and his little petty slights.
Yeah, your wife is ugly.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's
Jesus. Yay, we like him.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, and I think one of the biggest revelations that I had in my reporting of this book was the tolerance, not just the tolerance generally for that type of ugliness and nastiness and personal vendetta. It was that the evangelical crowd told themselves that they were not only okay with it, but that a lot of them liked it. And these guys like Pete Wehner, who was a former Bush speechwriter, who will no longer call himself evangelical because of the association with the Trump evangelicals, has a theory that, you know, that kind of mean-spiritedness was always running under the surface in evangelical crowds because of just the othering that happens in a lot of evangelical churches, and that people, like, they laugh. I mean, this is what people forget, and I try to get into this in the book, is that when the day that Trump insulted John McCain as not a war hero because he'd been captured.
Right. I thought that was the end. I thought it was the end. I thought that was the end of him.
Everybody did. But you know what? Like, had we been, listen, I'm guilty as you are. Had we been carefully watched, listening and paying attention there, he spoke those words in front of an evangelical audience in Iowa and the audience laughed.
No. Huh. Yeah. Well, they got their court. And
they got everything they ever wanted, right?
That's yes, the subtitle of the book. Mm-hmm. But let's very good.
Yes.
Yeah. You know how to sell books. Okay. The name of the book, title of the book, let's call it title. Insurgency, subtitle, How Republicans Lost Their Party and Got Everything They Ever Wanted. Jeremy, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I thought it was a great conversation.
I was okay. I held up my end. I know that. This was fun. Thank you. And really recommend the book very highly.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.